Accession number 7310, roll number 5.
Colonel Cleve, tape 5. This seems to imply that you felt the Somme was a success, that you were getting somewhere.
I hardly think so, because after all, at the end of the Somme, we hadn't got very far. We had only really captured a few German trenches. So I should say, as battles go, it was a failure in the sense that we didn't capture any appreciable amount of ground. A certain amount. We did capture a lot of German frontline trenches, but we hardly got beyond them, except in a few rare places, I think. So it was an awful, at a frightful expense of ammunition and men and all those things, just to had such a little result at the end of it. I think that must have impressed people, and that gradually began to make the mind a little more mobile, which on my second experience in France, I think I found there was a little more mobile thinking then.
And yet you say the morale was very high during the battle.
It depended very much on the unit concerned. Some infantry, poor things, they had a terrible time. Sometimes their morale did really give way, but they were awfully good about it because although they, I know they funked, a lot of the men funked going over the top, as it was called, but they knew they had to do it. The officers, of course, felt the same way. We've got to do it, we don't like to do it. And they did, and they knew they were going to their deaths, and they just accepted it. But the morale was never... yes, it was rather difficult to describe morale, but it was never so bad that men refused to fight or deserted, only except in a very few cases. I must say, as a whole, the morale was marvellous for any army of the enormous size of the British Army during World War I. We would never have won it without a superb morale on the whole.
How about your own team at your gun battery? You were mentioning the Durham miners who did this tunneling so effectively. Were they a good group of men that you had?
Oh, they were marvellous. I don't honestly think we could have had a better group of men than those Durham miners. We think of miners now striking and wanting more pay and that sort of thing. There was no suggestion of it with them. They were all volunteers, every one of them. They weren't called up. The battery really consisted mostly of regular soldiers, most of whom became NCOs, and these wonderful Durham miners. And they just sprang to it whenever they knew there was a job to be done. They were such a pleasant lot to work with. I think that helped us enormously to be such a good battery. We couldn't have been a good battery with men who were only half-hearted or wore their hearts on their sleeves. But these were wholeheartedly good chaps, and that's what it was. It was such a pleasure to work with them.
Do you think there was a difference between the early volunteers and the later conscripts?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure, because the conscripts, a lot of them... Well, I suppose the Durham miners, of course, had a lot to lose because they left their families behind and they left their job behind, which was a steady one. And then came along the conscripts who had the same things, the same situations behind them. On the other hand, they were conscripted, and they knew it. And they were there, and, well, they did what they had to, but without the enthusiasm that we had from the volunteers. But they did do well, I must say, very well, and they fought like cats and dogs when the final advance took place, and did extremely well then. But I think they were a bit shaken at first at having been called up, and then having to do their very severe army training, and then realizing that there was a job to be done, which they did when they got out of France, and I think their whole attitude changed then.
You were mentioning that some of the infantry funked it in the battles. You know, did this mean that they were reluctant to obey orders and go over the top? Were there instances of that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think, you see, many of them suffered from shell shock. And it was perfectly genuine. If you hadn't got a high degree of morale or intelligence or whatever it was, I don't know what it would be, but there were genuine cases of shell shock, when shells had burst so near them that it shattered their nervous system. And they had to be carried away and became casualties in hospital. There were quite a lot like that. Although when I say funked it, not in the sense of being cowardly, not a bit, but in the sense that they, shall we say, I think a better expression might have been feared what they had to face. Then when they knew they had to face it, they were marvellous at pulling themselves together and doing it. Whatever. I think that's the best way to put it. I think perhaps I shouldn't say funked, but that was a simple way of describing a little more complicated situation.
How about fear in your own case? Were you ever very frightened?
I think I was automatically, I'm a very nervous person, and I'm terribly nervous when I get onto a concert platform until I settle down to it, and then I enjoy it. I think I was nervous when I first heard the bombardment on the Somme, but I made a deliberate point of overcoming my nerves, and I think I succeeded in doing it. And it wasn't too long, a matter of hours, on the actual Somme when we moved to Heberton, and I first experienced those dead bodies I had to walk over, that I overcame all fear, and it meant nothing to me. No, I think, no, it did mean a lot. No, I mustn't say that. I overcame all fear. And I know I shouldn't say it, but I suppose I braved the very nasty situations I had to face, because I jolly well knew there was a job to be done, and I knew we all intended in our battery to do our very best. And when we had that spirit, it overcame all fear. I'm quite sure of that. So I don't think I feared. No, I think I got over that in the end.
Did you dread getting wounded, ever?
I wasn't wounded on the Somme, but I was wounded on the Ancre. Seriously wounded. Shall we get on to that?
I think we will finish the Somme first,
yes,
if that's all
yes,
right with
all right,
you.
Yes.
But I would very much like
yes,
to ask
yes,
you about
yes,
your wound.
Yes.
When the Somme battle came to a close, did
yeah.
things just stop? Did you know the battle was ended? Were you officially told to cease fire at a certain time?
No, we weren't told anything about it, really. But we imagined that the end of the Somme as a battle was taking place, because firstly, it was forced upon both sides to be economical with the shooting because of the terrible mud and the movements you couldn't fight. in that awful mud as you could had it been dry. So I think for that reason it gradually came to an end, and I should say the months as from December to March on the Somme were fairly peaceful, as war, anything peaceful can happen in a war. There wasn't the same danger about those, a lot of shedding now and again, and one had to go through a great deal of it, but only rather spasmodically. So it wasn't continuous as it was at the in the first few months of the Somme. And then it was that we expected things to happen in the way of moving position, and they did.
What did it look like towards the end of 1916, this sort of territory around the Somme?
Oh, it was terrible, because you could only see rolling, I was going to say downland, in the sense that there were no trees, and just a few stumps of trees to show where a village had been, the occasional little bit of a wall or something, and that's all there was. All the villages had been destroyed in the front line, and completely, and the trees had mostly been broken down to stumps, as you can see from the many, many photographs of the Somme battlefield, which were taken at that time. There's a very good system of official photography at that then.
I mean, it's this thing.
Did you actually see any of the photographers yourself?
Not very often, because we were far too busy to bother about photography. And if they happened to be taking a photograph, that was that. But we took not the slightest notice of them or interest in them.
How about war correspondents? Did you ever meet those?
No, never met any. No, I don't think I've ever been asked about the war until you came today. At least, not that I can remember.
I wonder now if you could tell me what happened to you after the Somme battle. I believe you mentioned you were in your similar, in the same position.
Yes.
For that winter.
Quite right. Well, we ended up in our position in O'Villas. There was really hardly any point in advancing forward because there was so little ground to, extra ground to reach, as there had been so little movement in front of us. So I think, I don't know whether it was for that reason. Anyway, it was decided to have a battle on the Ancre. And so a very short time before the Battle of the Ancre, we were sent up to take part in it. And we had to find a position just in front of a village called Beaurain, a suburb of Arras, which was quite really quite intact, but we made use of all the little gardens of the houses for ammunition, and there were terrific piles of ammunition built up in all these gardens and wherever they could do it. And then we found a battery position, not a very good one, about half a mile in front of Beaurain, and that was a position for the Battle of the Ancre. And we were billeted in the houses in Beaurain because there just wasn't time to dig dugouts. And I remember on one occasion a general who had the reputation of being, I forget what his name was, mad somebody, because he was extraordinarily brave, and he was known for walking about just in the front line and all like that on the top of the ground, and not caring two hoots for the Germans or anybody else. And one day he said to me, come along, I want to take you with me to see the as much as we can of the German position. So off we went, and I really was terrified, because he didn't mind about the front line. Actually, it was very quiet then, but we might have been sniped at and got. But he walked up and he said, and he stopped in one place, and we'd already passed the front line with all their banners glistening in the sun, banners drawn, and we stood in front of these banners, and he took out his glasses, and we both had to look at our glasses all around the German ground. And there were their trenches, and they said, look here, you see that, I think, ought to be shelled, and there's very likely a gun position there, and that kind of thing. So I made my notes and all like that, and we got away without even having had a shot fired. So I suppose he knew better than I did. And we got away. Then the bombardment began. No, it didn't. It had hardly begun. No, we hadn't opened fire, I don't think. We'd just registered this, that's what it was. We just registered our guns, which means we had made sure that we'd fixed their positions on the map, and we were pointing to special targets in the enemy country by survey. And then I was told, we'd only been there a day, I think, or two, and I was told to go back and see whether I could get billets for the men who had been camping out in the open, sleeping out in the open. This was just before April, or the first few days of April 1917. And I went back to Bahrain, and with an awfully nice, we had attached to us a very nice a pioneer officer called somebody de la Pure Pierce, a very well-known aristocratic family, and he was prepared to help us with our digging and all that kind of thing and finding positions. So it was quite obvious that he should come with me, and we were going around looking at the houses to see where we could billet the men. When all of a sudden a convoy of lorries with ammunition, filled with ammunition, arrived, which they were going to dump to add to these dumps already there in the village. And evidently it was spotted by a German plane. We ourselves happened to be in the village square at the time. We just emerged from a dugout opposite the Marie, the little town hall, and a German the convoy had just also reached the square, and a German shell, suddenly, the very first one they fired, hit the leading lorry, sent it up in fireworks and all like that. The fireworks set off the next lorry set off, and the whole place became ablaze, then gradually the ammunition dumps caught. So De La Pierce and I, we decided, somebody told us that there was a good cellar in the town hall, so we ran like hares across the square and dived down into the cellar to find it was already occupied by about 40 infantry, I think. But it was a cellar. And it only had a tiny little vent hole about a foot square facing south. And that was all the air that we could get. And we went down the staircase down into the cellar. And shelling went on. And then we knew that the town hall had been hit over our heads and was blazing. And the heat from the blaze was quite suffocating, and I knew that if we stayed there we would probably be suffocated, the whole lot of us. So I said, I'm going off to see whether we can get out. And I climbed the staircase, and the whole place was ablaze, in ruins already, ablaze around me, and I was just going across what remained of the hall, and I got hit. And I crawled down to the basement because my legs were all right, and I'd been hit in three places. One was in my left eye, and that had to be bandaged up, and another one was in my thigh, and that didn't worry me a bit because I was mobile. But the one in my head was very troublesome, extremely painful, and of course made that eye blind. And Beresford Pierce immediately bandaged me up, was awfully good about it. And while I was being bandaged, I yelled out to the men, "For God's sake, run for your lives! Otherwise, if you don't, you'll get suffocated." And they took my advice, and they all scampered out. I never heard any more of them. So I can only hope that they did escape with their lives. But we were down there, he and I alone, gradually being suffocated. And we said, "Well, now we must go. We can't stay any longer." So he half carried me up the stairs. By that time, the town hall had been burnt out. The whole village was still, fireworks still bursting all over the village, with every dump there was there going up. All the houses were destroyed. And we knew the direction that we had to go in to get to the battery. And I was a little bit, I couldn't walk awfully well. So he half carried me, and we took a bit of cover from a stone wall which was on the enemy side of where we had to go to get to the battery. Then we were due to turn right, and then we'd get into the battery. At that moment, another shell came over the wall and burst somewhere near us, and a splinter from it went right through my right arm, but it went right through and out again, and I can hardly see it. I can't find the place where it was even now, but still that was a third one. And he had to carry me because I really couldn't see with either eye where I was going, and we crawled back to the battery position. It was only a few hundred yards away in that way, and of course an ambulance was sent for. And I was taken to the dressing station, which was in a wood a little way back. And by that time I was getting very faint. And I was put into a marquee where there were hundreds of bodies all lying on the floor. And I was added to them, lying on the floor, waiting to be inoculated with morphia. And I was thankful for that. And I'm only aware of the fact that it was there was a railway line. I don't know where it was, but it was in a wood, and the remains of a wood, and there was a railway line in the wood, and an ambulance train, Prince Christian ambulance train, I think it was, Princess Christian, on the siding. And that was the last thing I saw for a long time. Then I was evidently put on the train, and when I woke up the next day, I couldn't see anything except a very blurred sight of a little electric glass chandelier thing in the middle of the room. And they told me I was in a hotel in Trepal, and it was a casualty clearing station. No, I think it may have been, I don't know what it was, and there were lots of wounded in it. And I was treated there. They couldn't do anything about the eye, it was completely bandaged. But gradually I got the sight back in the other one, reasonably. And I had an elder sister who was then doing soldiers' homework in Rouen, and she came and visited me there, and we had a very nice time. We went down to Trepal, I could walk then, to Trepal port, and found it a charming little fishing village, quite unaffected by the war. the most picturesque place, and I thought, oh, I'd love to come back to La Tréport. I never have. And then soon we were evacuated to England in the most lovely Belgian cross-channel ship, beautifully ornamented inside with decorations in the Adams style, I don't know what, Belgian style or something, very comfortable. And then I was put on an ambulance train and taken up to London, and I didn't realise where I was, and I woke up in Whitechapel Hospital. And then the surgeon came round the next day and decided it was too serious to operate. And my parents, meanwhile, had got a telegram from the War Office to say that I'd been seriously wounded. And they were awfully worried, of course, and came and saw me. And, however, I gradually got better and better. And then they decided I was fit enough to go to a convalescent home. So they asked me where I would like to go, and they named several places. Oh, I said London, because my parents were then still living in Wimbledon, and I knew I could go there and see them. And so they said, all right, well, you can go to Lady Dudley's home in Mornington Lodge, Mornington Crescent, now, of course, destroyed. And it was the most beautiful house, lovely pictures all around in all the rooms, and lovely lawn and summer house, etc. And we had a lovely time there, sitting in armchairs in the garden and relaxing. And I had a very amusing experience there, which has nothing to do with the war, so perhaps I shouldn't mention it. But it was run by an old lady called Mrs. Minogue, and she was dressed in widow's weeds and had a black sort of straw hat on, no veil, but straw hat. And she ran the thing, I think, at her own expense. And Lady Dudley, of course, was an excellent person who did a lot of soldiers, a lot of convalescent homes, and this was one of them. And she was awfully kind, and she used to come round and talk to us all. And there was a very nice matron there, and so on. And the matron said to me one day, "Would you like to have lunch with Mrs. Minogue in her private home?" So I said, oh, yes, I would, and I was open to anything like that. So they arranged a date, and I said, could my mother come with me, because I'd rather like her to come. Oh, yes, she said. So my mother and I went to her home, which is in Berkeley Square. Oh, magnificent house. She must have pots of money, and filled with antique furniture. And my mother and I were taken up to the drawing room where we met her. We were very deeply impressed. And then we went along a long corridor, had a very simple meal because of rationing, and went along a long corridor till we got to the dining room, which was right at the back of the house. Oh, yes, that's where we had the meal. And she was awfully kind. And we said goodbye, and my mother and I said, well, isn't she a nice person? We both agreed that she was. And then, of course, we